or to dealing with issues like girls and cars or guitars. What do you feel is your role in terms of perpetuating the sort of thinking where you have access to people, you have access to their instincts, they're impressionable. In some cases, literally, they're in the palm of your hand. In the course of a live performance, you've spoken out on things in various contexts, whether during your Chicago show since 1983 or 4, you were talking about our Peace Museum, appearing at events like at Amnesty International, the Amnesty International tours, Live Aid, your participation in the Sun City Project, and so on. How do you feel you're perpetuating, not to make this too long a question, how do you feel your role is in terms of the historical role of the performer in terms of making people aware of reality?
Well, I wouldn't take that on. I mean, I wouldn't take on the job of making people aware of reality. I'd take on the job trying to make myself aware of reality. And being in rock and roll band certainly removes you from reality, so that is a full-time job. I don't know.
I don't think anyone writes a song. Certainly we don't write a song because we feel there isn't enough understanding about it or whatever. We just write a song if we feel strongly about something. And we just, you know, tell it like it is. That's really the bottom line. We don't think about necessarily why this song is important to us to write. It's just if it seems right at the time.
But what about the issues and the causes? Deciding that as a band, as a group, you're going to go on tour and do the Amnesty circuit.
Well, to make people aware
of that organization.
Yeah, the difference is we don't decide as a group, we decide as individuals. And I think we've always approached any issue from a human individualistic stance and decided how we felt about it. And if it became part of our lives, well, then it became part of our music.
There is a sense of continuity here, because the next song that we're going to be hearing, something that's never appeared on an album, is a live recording of a Bob Dylan song. And this is something you've done in the past. It's Maggie's Farm. Let's listen to You Too. Well, that was really something. We've never heard an interpretation of Maggie's Farm quite like that. I think you'd have to call it an interpretation. Bono, what led to that approach on that song?
It's a pretty... pretty twisted version, as I was saying. Well, it's like it's a kind of classic case of how you can reinterpret a song to your own point of view. We originally performed at a concert for the unemployed people back home in Dublin City in Ireland. And a lot of those people, there's a lot of emigration out of Ireland. And, you know, whether it be to America or in this case, to the UK, you know, people have to go there to find jobs and stuff, and they resent the fact they don't want to go. They want to stay at home, but they've got to go away to work, and they have to go away and be under Margaret Thatcher, if you like. And so we reinterpreted that, and there's a lot of anger in it. And I juxtaposed it with Cold Turkey, the John Lennon song, because we got a really bad heroin problem in Dublin, and when people feel that they got no way out, you know, and there's no way out, sometimes they can get into finding more dangerous ways out of their situation, like heroin, for instance, which is a very dangerous drug indeed.
So then, in a word, it might be correct to say that was the sound of rage that we just heard.
Yeah, there's a lot of pain, and that's the way it should be. You know, music should be able to be interpretive. You know, if you listen to a jazz man play, you know, if he hits those notes, bends the strings, because he's trying to paint a picture. And that's all Edge was trying to do, I think it's fair to say. Same as in Bullet the Blue Sky, just trying to paint a picture with sound. And when Larry and Adam are rolling on the beat there, it's just trying to paint a picture. It's not a rock and roll song, and it's not, you know, three-minute, four-minute job, and maybe it seems self-indulgent to some, but that's the way we viewed it.
Not at all. That was really something. And thanks for sharing that recording with us, too. We'll be having some more recordings of U2 in concert that you've never heard anywhere else as the show continues. This is Trip Through Your Wires with U2, and we'll return momentarily. We're live in New York City. We have another 30 minutes to go or so. We're tripping through your wires with U2. We'll be returning to the phones in just a minute. Let me reintroduce one of our co-hosts, Linda Ryan from KUSF in San Francisco.
Thank you. We were talking about Bob Dylan a little bit ago, and protest songs in general. And I guess in your own way, the songs you write, some of them would be maybe considered modern day protest songs, about inequality and that sort of thing. Bob Dylan, was he like an influence that way, or what?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Yeah, I really like Bob Dylan's music, and his later music as well as his earlier music.
Mm-hmm.
I really like, and we got a chance to play with him live on stage. He came up on stage with us in Los Angeles, and we did two of his songs.
I was also gonna ask, you know, Tom Petty's been on the road with Bob, and so has the Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
How about a Bob Dylan U2 tour?
Remember what we were saying about playing other people's songs?
Yeah, might be a bit of a problem.
Playing other people's songs. Yeah. No, I don't think. I think Bob's better off with the Grateful Dead.
Actually, I seem to remember on the stage in Los Angeles, we were trying to work out the chords to Knocking on Heaven's Door, and Bob didn't even remember them, so made me feel a bit better.
Yeah.
Would you consider it an ultimate compliment if Bob did one of your songs?
Oh, he's already said something about that.
Yeah, he said, as we were leaving the stage, I said, you know, those songs are going to last forever, Bob. And he said, yeah, he says, your song's going to last forever, too. Only thing is, no one's going to be able to play them. they're hard to figure out, you know. That's why I felt, you know, for that guy who's was playing the guitar earlier on, saying, you know, trying to work out what the Edge does. Because, I mean, I've even tried to do that. You know, I've picked up the guitar. You know, I've had exactly the same settings at the Edge, puts it the same guitar, put my fingers where he puts them, and just this god-awful noise comes out. So it's kind of, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it, I think.
Okay, I think we'll probably take it back to the phones right now. We've got Jenny from WRIF in Detroit. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Hi, Jenny.
Okay, I have a few questions I'd like to ask.
Oh, you know what, Jenny? I think you're going to have to turn your radio down, or we'll all be very confused.
Okay, here we go.
Sorry.
That's better.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a few questions I'd like to ask, but first I'd like to say something, if I may. I'd just like to say that though Time and a lot of other magazines have named you the band of the 80s in 87, you have always been the band of the late 70s and the 80s, and I don't know what took them so long to figure that out.
Hey-o.
Brilliant.
And it also, all right, on to the questions, I'd like to ask if we your fans would ever be able to
come around for tea.
Hear some of your old singles like Concentration Cramp and The Fool, or can you even remember the lyrics from those songs?
How did you get a hold of them?
Well, I've read about them. I've read about them in every book I can find about you guys.
They've never been even released, those songs.
No, huh? I was just wondering if you even remember the lyrics to them and if we would be able to even ever hear them.
There were never any lyrics anyway, Jenny, because Bonner used to write the lyrics 5 minutes before we recorded the songs, and since they were never recorded, I doubt if they're more than a couple of lines for them.
Okay.
And I've forgotten the chords.
I also wanted to know if I could then, if you guys are planning on coming back to Michigan on tour this year.
I'm sure we are. Hold on.
You know what? They're going to be... No, it's Missouri. looking frantically at this information. Very close to Michigan, I think, Jenny, is the answer. But we don't have any definite dates right here.
Okay, well, nothing announced.
Nothing announced just yet. But I'd say stay tuned to Riff, and you'll hear the information.
Yeah, I'd say we'll probably be there about the 18th of November myself.
Okay.
Sometime around then.
Okay, great. I don't know how to do it, but I'm going to try my hardest to get main floor seats this time.
Good luck.
Yeah, really.
And good. Hey, and one thing, you know, if we do get back that way, and it's not this year, it'll be you know, next year or the next year, but don't pay too high prices for our tickets, you know. There's a lot of people making money at it, you two, you know, by ripping off our fans, by putting out cheap stuff and charging too high prices for our tickets. You know, our tickets are going for $100 and $150.
Yeah, before the concert this year, your tickets were going for like $250 to $300.
Well, I'm in the band, and let me tell you, we're not worth it.
Yeah, Yes, you are. But I have to pay for it anyway, so I wouldn't be able to.
No, don't do it. You know, those guys are just sons of... It's bad news. And, you know, if we were to play to all the people who wanted to see us, you see, we'd have to be play and play. We'd never write any songs. We'd never record them. That's why we're trying to play some of these big places as well as some of the small places. But it's hard, you know. It's really hard to get this right. But there's a lot of people taking advantage of the fact.
Well, now, Bono, as a group, you guys really do try to be more in control of the whole distribution of tickets in around the country and around the world than the average artist, don't you? I mean, you try to remain in control of the ticket prices and the number of tickets that are being made available to the public.
Sure.
Well, it's a problem we've experienced in Europe and in the States, the scalping of tickets, and so we were a bit aware of it, you know, probably a lot more than most groups. So we try to, you know, cooperate with the promoters and make sure that the tickets go out in a way that's fair, at least. I mean, for the last couple of tours, we haven't been able to do enough shows, really, to fulfill the demand. So it's a bit of a problem. As far as ticket prices go, what we say to every promoter is, you know, just make sure the tickets are lower or the same price as, you know, every other band that's in town, and let's not, you know, just because there's a high demand, let's not just hike the price of the tickets. That's why the scalping thing is such a piss off for us, because we really try to be sure that the tickets go out at good value prices.
And to an extent, the same is true with records. When you released the live album a few years ago, you called it a mini LP, so that you could charge a more reasonable price for it, for your fans.
Well, people already had the song, so that's the way we felt about it.
Well, we're going to listen to a live recording now that's not available on one of your commercially available LPs. This is a song that originally appeared on the War LP, and it's Sunday, Bloody Sunday from U2.
Turn on your tape recorders.
U2, live version of Sunday, Bloody Sunday. Trip through your wires. We are live in the DIR radio network, and we'll have time for some more phone calls and also for more live music. I did want to ask one question of Larry. You know, the band, U2, has always stood for artistic freedom, doing things your way. And I know that this, I've heard this extends even to merchandising of the band's T-shirts and the things that come out. And that you have a direct... overseeing sort of managerial viewpoint. You are the bottom line. You clear things. You make sure they come to the band's standard.
Yeah, just check quality of the, maybe even the printing on it. And just all the T-shirts are designed by Steve Avril, who does the sleeve designs at their records. Mm-hmm. And he does the T-shirts as well. So everything comes under our control. We just see everything that's done. We come up with most of the ideas. So when the stuff is printed up, we just see it just to make sure it's okay. And we've employed a guy named Chris Parks. He actually oversees the whole thing. And then, you know, just there are people that we actually employ just to take care of the whole situation, make sure that people don't get ripped off. You know, and I mean, we've been criticized a lot for in Europe for the T-shirts and stuff being sort of expensive, which is not really true, but... It's 100% cotton
it's
stuff.
It's not compared to other bands.
No, I mean, it's not, because we take a special interest in it, you know. Mm-hmm. But in comparison to other bands, I mean, I don't know any other band who takes so much time over the merchandising.
You know, this also extends as far as sponsorship of tours. There's a lot of these bands that are going on the road with huge corporate sponsors to pick up the tab on their tours. And as of yet, U2 has not resorted to that.
Huh.
Do you think there'd ever be a plan or... Is this something you
actually... The problem is we've never found a beer that we liked enough to be sponsored by.
You couldn't agree on one beer.
Like Guinness, we might consider.
Guinness.
See, the Guinness over here isn't fantastic, to be honest now, Carter. Yeah.
I think it's just like, you know, you might as well put on a suit and tie and go and work for them, you know? And there are rare exceptions, you know, when it's okay to stand beside, you know, something like, you know, Larry stood beside Harley Davidson. And he's put his name to that because that's an American company making something special, the Harley Davidson motorbike, and that's something special, and something to be proud of, and something to stand beside. Like things like Yamaha being good occasionally to like Larry and the rest of the band, so they don't mind that, you know, or not things like that, but I just the idea of getting involved in that whole big business thing, just, you know, just, it's not interesting. It's just, it's not the right thing for a rock and roll band to do. It's, I think.
Why don't we go back to the phones and give some of our listeners a chance to ask you some questions. We have Connie listening on WMMR in Philadelphia. Hello, Connie.
Hi.
Live in the air.
Hi, Connie.
Hi. First, I wanted to say that your music has a lot of meaning for me.